Good morning, Rabotai. Welcome to Breakfast in the Class. The week of Breakfast in the Class, sponsored by Michael Shem Tov, dedicated in honor of the birth of a baby boy to Ivan and Ariel Maman, Siman Tov Mabruk, and as well dedicated for the speedy and complete Refuah Shlema for Shel Rachel Batzara from her family, Refuah Shlema. As well, Breakfast in the Class is dedicated in loving memory of Sandra Gasberg, Aleha Shalom Liilui Nishmat Sandra Bat Tessi, for her first Azkara, dedicated by her daughter Frida Rose. Ruach HaLanai Terichena B'Gan Eden. Also dedicated in loving memory of Vanessa's mother this week, Diana Cohen, Aleha Shalom Liilui Nishmat, Diana Bat Sophie with Charles, sponsored by Vanessa and Joe God, and in loving memory of Nurit Noshan Zamir, Roshan Zamir Liilui Nishmat, Nurit Nushafarin, Bat Hanom V'Yehuda, sponsored by Asher Roshan Zamir, Ruach HaLanai Terichena B'Gan Eden. As well, dedicated in loving memory of Ms. Lily Safra Liilui Nishmat Leah Bat Chana. Her philanthropy has reached so many throughout the entire world. And in loving memory, Liilui Nishmat Joseph Major, Yosef Ben Rina Victoria, their father's favorite parasha, Ani Yosef, and for the Askara of their grandfather, Morris H. Levy, Moshe and Victoria, sponsored by Rain and Ezra Cohen and Raquel and Gabby Haber. And finally, Breakfast in the Class, dedicated loving memory, Liilui Nishmat Chaim Ben Rachel, sponsored by Ezra Yosef Kada. I would also encourage everybody, we have our year-end campaign for the synagogue and for Chazak to be able to put out all the wonderful classes and do all the great events that we're doing. Please join us and be a partner with us at charity.extra/EJS-Chazak. I'll post it on the video. You should be able to see the link, and we'll post it as well along with Spotify with the link, so everyone can be involved as well in spreading the Torah and the messages and the Judaism that are emanating from this building and our amazing team. My friends, the Pasuk tells us, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, Vayomer Bi Adoni, please my master. Our rabbis explain that the story over here is coming in right off of a cliffhanger. We know the story with Joseph and the brothers. Yosef and the brothers, they decide to sell him. They hate him. We explained why. We've talked a lot about this. Until finally they get to a situation where now they're standing in front of Yosef. He has them right where he wants them. Everything is exactly as he imagined. He's about to get they're bowing to him like in his dream, etc., etc. He's got everything set up exactly right. Benjamin is held as a pawn, if you will, in the story, as a captive. The brothers don't know that it's Yosef. Yehuda steps forward to defend Benjamin after the goblet of Yosef has been found in his sack. And now, this is where we begin. Vayigash elav Yehuda. And Yehuda approaches him. Vayomer bi adun. And he says, please, my master. Please. And he goes on to tell him in great detail everything that's happened up until that point. Please don't listen. Please don't turn your heart away. Please listen carefully. Please listen to my words. He's begging Yosef, okay? He approaches Yosef and he begs Yosef. And he tells the whole story about how everything transpired. And now he says, and if I'm to leave Benjamin here, take me as a slave instead. But let my brother go home, because if my brother goes home, and if I go home and the boy is not with me, I can't see my father falling apart, from the lack, from being unable to see his son. Wild, just extraordinary, language that's being used. So my friends, I want to share with you the words of Rabbeinu Bahya. And there's many lessons here. Maybe we'll cover some of the other lessons throughout this week. Rabbeinu Bahya says as follows. What does this mean, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, and Yehuda approaches? And he says, let me speak in your ear, my master, and don't be upset with your servant, ki kamocha kiparo. Matzinu lashon hagasha. This language, vayigash, right? The root of that word, which is gash, okay? Gishana, we find with Yitzchak Avinu, right? When he tells Yaakov to come forward, right? This word we find in three different ways. In one case, it means din. It means approaching for judgment. Where do we find it approaching for judgment? V'higisho Adonav el hadelet. by the story of the Jewish servant who wants to stay a servant after serving his 7 years for servitude. And he's supposed to go free, and he chooses not to go free. So we talk about the time where his master brings him to the Beit Din. He gishor Adonai ve'la delet, right? Ve'la mezuzah. He brings him to the door and to the doorpost. Okay? We find it over there. So we find it in the case of judgment. We find it in the case of milchama, of war. And we also find it in a case of pius, where someone is appeasing someone. Illustrating, my friends, what Rabbeinu Bachya is saying is that the language of Vayigash, and he approached, a person can approach for judgment, for appeasement, or for war. But there's something else, I think, here that has to kind of catch our attention. This appeasement that Yosef, that Yehudah is trying to do to Yosef, he comes forward to Yosef. Now, Yehudah, we know, was the strongest of all of the brothers. But it's Yehudah that comes forward and says with a broken heart, please, my master, he calls him master, he's bowing in front of him, so to speak. He's pouring out his heart in front of him. There was a rabbi who was once approached by someone in the community. And his name was Rav Sher. And the man came to him and he said, Rabbi, I see the yeshiva that you're building here. It's so beautiful. What you're doing with all the students. So he says, where do you send your students? Where do you send, your children? And the man says, I wish I was able to send them to a Jewish school. He says, but unfortunately, my wife, we're not on the same page. And she absolutely refuses to give the kids a Jewish education. He says, what do you mean? The man says, I've raised this subject before. She's so anti-Jewish education for our kids that it's not an option on the table. He says, and I know that if I push the issue with my wife, she's going to ask me for a divorce. So what can I do? The kids are not in school, in Jewish school, because of Shalom Bayit, in order to have peace in the house. I'm sure many listeners will relate to this. Not necessarily about a Jewish school versus a non-Jewish school, but situations in the house, in the home, where things are very important to one partner, and the other partner maybe perhaps just disagrees apathetically, just doesn't care, doesn't mean that much, and they're kind of like having to go along with things in order to maintain the status quo. Well, he says to the rabbi, what else can I do? And the rabbi said something, it kind of gave me goosebumps. And the rabbi says, did you cry to her? He says, what do you mean? He says, well, did you go and cry in front of her and beg her and plead with her and make her understand how important this is for you? Maybe the reason why she's saying no or she's disagreeing is because she doesn't care and she doesn't know that you care. I mean, you're saying you care, but she doesn't know the depth of how much this is bothering you, how much this upsets you, how much this means to you. Maybe if she knew how much it meant to you, then she would feel differently. A lot of men, they find it very difficult to show emotion. They find it difficult to cry. They feel like they're going to be considered less of a man in the eyes of their wife or family if they don't hold it together. All the time I remember hearing, people say at a funeral, I promised myself I wouldn't cry. Why did you make that? That's a silly promise to make, right? You're at a funeral, you love the person. Like, of all the things you could have promised yourself, that's what you went for? Right? Why is this so important to you? I saw someone, I actually remember going on a trip to Poland with a group, and someone said, Rabbi, one of the things that made this trip very powerful was that we saw when we were at certain places and you were speaking about things, you were crying. And I never saw in my life, I never saw my father cry. If ever There was something going on. My father was very emotional. He would turn his face away or leave the room to maintain his composure. I never in my life, so to see a man crying, showing emotion about something, was very powerful for me. I was blown away. I mean, obviously, a lot of these things depend on how you're raised, who your father figure is in your life. You know, we emulate our parents, and we think we create for ourselves these standards for behavior and response to things based on the figures that we have in our family. My father was and is an emotional person. You know, if someone comes to the synagogue and they have a sob story, a difficult situation, they're trying to raise money, my father's already crying his eyes out, even though he sees stories like this every day. It could be five different people. And you see my father, you see his eyes welling up with tears. He's a very compassionate, he's a very empathic person. So maybe that was the role model. That was what I saw growing up. So it was easy for me. But my friends, I always love to point this out. It is the strongest of the brothers, Yehuda, that is capable of coming forward to Yosef. Vayigash Yehuda. He comes forward so that Yosef can see clearly how much this means to him. You know, a lot of times, you know, when people are making decisions, or people are figuring out their response to you in something, they're responding to what they imagine the value of that thing is in your life. So as an example, let's say a person goes to to get a job. And there's a condition of employment that the place has that, you know, every person that you have to fill out these forms or, you know, I remember once I was going to a school, you know, and they really wanted me to teach in the school. And I had no interest in grading papers and marking attendance and sitting at PTA meetings. I just wanted to teach the kids. I just wanted to inspire, wake them up, let them enjoy what they were learning. That to me was the most important thing. And I didn't work for the school. And the school could not deal with the fact that I was not prepared. So I was a free teacher. They were desperate for me to teach there, but they could not get over their own limitations for what they thought that a teacher needed to be. Even though I wasn't working for them and they weren't paying me. Right? They could not, even for free, they could not get over it. And I understand that certain schools operate in certain ways, but the same way schools operate in certain ways, and they have their things. People are like that too. If you want someone to jump their own tracks, you know, to act in a way or to decide or to move in a way which maybe is not easiest or most natural for them, and you want them to do it because it means something to you, don't forget to show them how much that thing means to you. Because if they're going to make that sacrifice on your behalf, they have to understand how much it means. So the rabbi said to this man, you fought, you yelled, you screamed. Did you cry? Did you cry in front of her to say to her, this is so important to me. This means the world to me. And I know it doesn't mean that much to you. And I know that your answer is no. But if you see how, I want you to know, if you decide to say no, I want you to know how much, how powerful and how important this is to me. My friends, I think that there's an unbelievable lesson in this word vayigash. And I wonder, in the end, Yehuda's speech to his brother, it breaks Yosef's resolve. He manages to get through. They manage to get back together. But imagine this same verse, this same story, this same speech that Yehuda makes, that ultimately makes the shalom happen in the family. Just without Vayigash, without Yehuda stepping forward to be seen by Yosef, so that Yosef understands how much this means. He's not reading it off a paper. Sometimes the only ingredient that's missing in fixing a very difficult situation is a willingness to be vulnerable. What a magnificent concept. a willingness to be vulnerable, a willingness to feel like you're putting your future and the situation at hand in the hands of somebody else. Be Adoni. Yehuda is the leader of the brothers, and he's calling this person who's a stranger to him. He's telling him, he's calling him master. He's telling him what he needs to hear so that he can communicate how much this means. I can't see my father suffer like this. My friends, this lesson, Vayigash, is in and of itself something I think that everybody can take home in their lessons for communication. Sometimes what's missing is not what you're saying. Yehuda's speech without Vayigash, it's clear from the Pasuk, would not have worked. Sometimes it's not the content of your words. Sometimes it's not what you're willing to say or what you're willing to bargain for. Yehuda is putting being a slave instead of Binyamin on the table. He's making great sacrifices in his speech. But it's not the speech that does it. It's the speech with the proximity that he has to Yosef. He comes all the way. He shares his emotion. He shares his position. Sometimes, my friends, a person will send a very beautifully worded email. Sometimes a person will send a megillah of texts. It's seven texts it's divided into because there's a maximum amount of characters. Sometimes you'll leave a very long voice note. If you do, everybody hates you. You'll leave a very long voice note and you'll be very clear about what you want and you'll have said all the right things. But you're missing the number one ingredient that we start here with. Vayigash Yehuda. You're not there. They're not looking at your face. They don't see how you're saying these words. How often has what you've said in a text or an email been misconstrued? I was talking with someone and he told me how badly he's desperate to have shalom in his house. So we talked over all the different things that were stopping them from getting, you know, back together, all the different problems that needed to be solved, all the sacrifice he'd be willing to make. And anyway, I saw him a little while later. I said, "How'd it go?" He says, "Terrible." I said, "Really? Why? What happened?" He goes, "They never responded to my email." I said, "You have so many years of pain, of sadness, of anger, of resentment under the bridge, and you sent an email? How easy is that to go to spam or trash? You know, do you know what time of day the person read your email? I don't know, people don't think. An email can be read at any time of the day or night. You know that, right? They can read your email in between the two most stressful meetings that they had of the day. That means that your email was read at max stress. Right? You know, sometimes you walk in, you're going to ask something, you realize that something is too much for the person to swallow, so you ask for half. You can't make that adjustment in an email. Sometimes you see that the person is very, very calm, very relaxed, very receptive. Then you know what? Instead of just saying, you know what, maybe we should get together, you know, once a year on the yard site of mom, if they're receptive, you might ask for double, triple, quadruple that. Get together once a month. You might be able to ask for much more. When you're asking for something that you think the other person does not want, the most important thing to have is proximity. Vayigash. Is to come to them. To let them see your face. To see their face. To speak the words in a way where they can be heard. And then perhaps the result is very different. So the rabbi says to this man, "You've yelled, you've screamed, you've cajoled, you've pleaded, you've begged. Did you cry? Does she know how much it means to you? Until you've communicated that, you know, she's not really deciding on what's going on. She's deciding on what she thinks is going on." I remember, and I'll end with this. I remember there were two wild stories that stuck out in my mind that made a very big impact on me. We only have time today for one of them. But I just want to share one story. There was a fellow, unfortunately, who went through the war. And at the end of the war, he'd lost everybody in his family. He was so angry and he was so bitter that he decided he's leaving. He's walking away from everything that he knows, from his community, from Judaism. He's going to go and fly and move somewhere else because he was angry at God, that God took not only his family, but the very last person alive in his family was his young son, and he lost his son in the concentration camps. He decided that's it, he's out. He moves to South Africa. Anyway, years and years go by, and he marries a non-Jewish woman, builds himself a nice non-Jewish family off in Australia, does very, very well for himself. Years and years pass, and some crazy way, something absolutely nuts happens until the man decides he's going to go to Yad Vashem, and as he types his name into Yad Vashem to see if they have his family on file, he sees his son's name, Yosef, and it says alive, and it says in Israel. And there's contact details. And he cannot believe what he's looking at. He literally is about to break down emotionally. He closes, he just runs out of the place, makes contact, and actually decides, realizes that his only son is alive. They have a tearful reunion. They can't believe all the time that they've missed. 50 years have gone by. The guy has family, children, grandchildren, he's religious. He's living in Israel, and he says, you know, I want to invite you, you know, to come down to South Africa to see me, to meet up with me. Anyway, my friends, in the story, what happens, a true story, when the fella goes back home, he tells his family about his newfound son. They can't believe it. They're a little bit, you know, kind of thrown by all of this. They, like, that part of his life was never part of their life. They're not Jewish. They don't necessarily relate in the same way. And they decide that, you know what, the time will come. Time's come for the family to meet the family. Unfortunately, before his son Shimon is able to go visit his father, Yosef Joe, the man passes away. And he leaves a fortune of 15 million pounds or dollars or whatever it was. And he decides to split it between his son from the Holocaust and his son from this non-Jewish woman living in South Africa. Anyway, the family can't believe it. The boy calls the family, says, you know, what are the funeral arrangements? I'm going to come, you know, I want to fly down there right away. And there's kind of a little bit of a cool response, like, you know, you just came into the family over here, you know, and now you're getting half of the inheritance, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They're kind of a little bit resentful of this guy. Is Johnny come lately? And he says, well, the funeral is going to be on this and this day. We're arranging it, in our local church. And the cremation is going to happen in wherever. The boy says to his stepbrother, he says, please, please don't cremate him. Please, if there's any way that he could have a Jewish burial, any way, you know, it would mean so much to me. And the man says, listen, I know that you 50 years ago were his son, but he hasn't had contact with you in so long. We're his family. We've lived with him all this time. He lived a non-Jewish life. We're not Jewish. This is our pastor or our church. This is what we're doing. I'm really sorry. You don't get to come into our life and tell us what to do with our father. But he says, but he's my father too. And they say, well, we've made the arrangements already. If you want to come, you're welcome to come, but this is what's happening. And the boy is begging, please, please, please. Anyway, nothing doing. He flies down to South Africa. He's going to give his last chance. He comes to his brother and he says, please do me a favor. He says, I need to speak with you before the funeral happens. He says, what? He goes, I can't tell you. This means so much to me. He says, the two of us were in the Holocaust. You know, they were burning us and putting us in ovens back then. To escape from that only to wind up in another oven, to me is the craziest thing in the world. He says, please, you must allow us to give him a proper Jewish burial. I'll take care of everything. The boy says, nothing doing. Finally, the son from Israel says, I'll make you a deal. He says, I will give up my entire portion of the inheritance if you let me take the body and bury it according to Jewish tradition, the right way. The guy is looking at his brother, $7.5 million, right? To instead of having his father be cremated, instead he's going to bury him. He sees the way his brother's speaking. He says, "Fine, take it." He says, "But we don't want to ever hear from you again." They sign whatever papers they sign, and he gives them the body of his father, and he brings his father to a Jewish burial after all those years. Someone after the funeral came to this man and said, "You know, you haven't seen your father in 50 years. You get this inheritance of all this money. You're able to walk away from it for one mitzvah. When was the last time you spent $7.5 million on a mitzvah?" And the man said something that I'll never ever forget. He said, "You know, my whole life I never had the chance to do any kibud av va'em to honor my father. I never had a chance to get him a cup of water. I never had a chance to, you know, take him to shul. I never had a chance to get him a birthday card. I never had a chance to get him a present." He says, "I only just met my dad." And he said, "And the only act in my entire life of honoring my father was to make sure that he had a Jewish burial." He said, "That to me was worth more than anything. And that's how I did it." My friends, Vayigash Yehuda, he understood that this moment was there, and maybe the reason why God had arranged for him to have this was so that he could have a giant chip to play. And he walks in after all this time and he puts it down and he says, "This is what honoring my father means to me. But you know what? I could tell you one thing. If he'd have done it on the phone, I don't even know with all the money in the world if he'd been able to show. But to go down there, to share those words that he shared with his half-brother, managed to actually get him what he wanted so badly." Human beings don't relate to phones. We don't have relationships with emails. We cannot feel the pulse or the excitement or the anger or the sadness in a text. So if you need something, and especially if it's difficult for the other person to give, make sure that you're there in person. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen v'amen.